Good afternoon. I want to call this meeting to order of House Finance, and it is 1:35 p.m. on Wednesday, February 22nd, and present are Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, myself, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Guttenberg, and Representative Thompson. And Co-Chair Foster will be joining us in a minute, as well as Representative Gren, who's in the Finance Subcommittee. So remind people about their cell phones, and then on today's schedule, we will be hearing two bills, HB 48, Architects, Engineers, and Surveyors, Board Extension, and then HB 24, listing U-47-700 as a controlled substance. And if it's the will of the committee, it's the other co-chair's intent to move both of those bills today. And we will then have David Teal, the Director of House Finance, give the committee a presentation on the new operating budget amendment system. So first I'd like to bring up HB 48, and if you'd like to go ahead and take a seat. So here to present it. HB 48 is the sponsor, Representative Tito, and his aide, Bianca Carpinetti. And we've been joined by Representative Pruitt. And so would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with the introduction of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sam Quito III. I am representative of House District 33, including Northern Southeast Alaska communities, as well as downtown Juneau and Douglas Island. And for the record also, I am a licensed civil engineer, and my practice of engineering is governed by the board that House Bill 48 is extending. And by that, I will offer up a potential conflict of interest because I am a member of the board or member of the licensee class. The bill you have before you, House Bill 48, is an extension of the sunset of the Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors Board, or more commonly known as the AELS Board. Since I think we're at 17 years now, so since 1998, there has been a landscape architect position as a non-voting member of the board, and what we are recommending with this sunset extension is to extend the board in accordance with the Division of Legislative Audit's recommendations, but also to make that temporary non-voting position that has been serving the board for the past 17 years a permanent and voting position. So it's bringing that position from temporary law into the statute. And that means a change from the board that says 10 to 11, but that's just recognizing that the temporary non-voting member is now a permanent member of the board. It is not removing any other representation from the board, and it is putting the landscape architect in as a representative of the board that's a full voting member. And this will allow, and we'll hear testimony from the board, but this will allow that individual who represents the landscape architects to fully engage in their position as well as be a voting member of the board. Right now, that person does review applications for landscape architecture in the state of Alaska and is performing duties as a full board member with the exception of being able to vote. So my simple presentation, we do have the Division of Legislative Audit here to talk about the audit. We do have members or individuals from the department to talk about specific questions about the bill, and we also have people online ready to testify on the House Bill 48.
Thank you. Are there questions for the sponsor? Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just curious on the Is there a statutory requirement that this board meet in person?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, as far as I know, there's no statutory requirement, but the department would be better suited to answer that question. I do know that there are opportunities for telephonic meetings, but when they are reviewing applications, those applications are typically presented in paper, and so the board members will break up by licensing division and review the applications for the director. So I do think that there are reasons for having those meetings be in-person meetings.
Right. Thank you very much.
And Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I read it in your statement, so I don't think I need to go through it. But it does, I'm just looking at the fiscal note, and adding the 11th member doesn't actually change any travel and per diem because they were already allowed to claim travel and per diem as non-voting members. Is that correct, then?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes. So it's recognition as a sunset that there will be costs to the board, but those costs are costs that already exist on the board. There will be no additional costs because that individual is already receiving support for travel and per diem.
And then another question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking at the total, the division ledge audit. It just mentions how many new registrations of landscape architects existed over fiscal year 13 to fiscal year 15, and it looks like there's only one or two or three. Do you know how many landscape architects there are across the state?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, my understanding is there's about 50 licensed landscape architects in Alaska.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions for the sponsor?
Oh, you got the
12 ones. Seeing none, I'd like to bring forward Chris Curtis, Legislative Audit Division, to the table to briefly walk the committee through the sunset audit for the board. Welcome, if you put yourself on the record and go ahead and walk us through.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I am your state legislative auditor. Legislative audit did a sunset audit, and the purpose of the sunset audit is to determine whether the board is serving the public's interest and whether it should be extended. Overall, we found the board was serving the public's interest by effectively registering and regulating architects, engineers, land surveyors, and landscape architects. We recommended the maximum extension allowed for in statute, which is 8 years, and we did not have a recommendation in this audit. But there is some information in the audit that might be helpful as you consider this bill. On page 7, you'll see at the end of FY13 that the board had a deficit of approximately $260,000. At that time, fees were increased. At the end of FY15, they had a surplus of over $740,000, at which point the fees were decreased. A schedule of the fees is on page 8 of the audit. The audit also discusses board composition. As Representative Keto noted, there is a temporary non-voting member. It was created in 1998. It was authorized in uncodified law, and every time the board was extended, it was again authorized in uncodified law as a temporary position. The position does act like a voting member in all regards, except that it does not vote. The original intent of the position was to assist the board in drafting regulations and representing the landscape architect profession. We did interview 7 board members as part of the audit, and we did ask the board members if they were in support of making this position permanent, and all 7 were in support.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Curtis? Seeing no questions about the audit, thank you very much. And next I'd like to bring Jannie Hovenden, Director of the Division of Corporation and Business Professional Licensing, table to walk the committee through the department's fiscal note.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Janie Hovenden. I'm the Division Director for Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. As you can see from the fiscal note, the bill is not asking for any additional funding for the board. It is to maintain and keep being able to spend on their behalf for these board activities. So $27,800 for one staff member and 11 board members to travel to to four board members meetings per year, $2,000 for advertising and public notices of those board meetings. So that's $200. $1,000 for training and conference fees for board members, $500 for honorariums and stipends for board meetings, and then $100 for commission sales for the booking of those board meetings. We are receipt-supported services, meaning that there's no general fund. This is paid for by licensees. And I can answer any questions.
Are there questions? seeing none, thank you very much. Seeing no questions, we'll go to public testimony, and I'll open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 48? Yes, please come forward and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Michelle Elfers. I'm a landscape architect with the Engineering and Public Works Department with the City and Borough of Juneau. I'm also a member of the Alaska Professional Design Council. We're a group that represents architects, engineers, landscape surveyors, landscape architects through member organizations throughout the state. And I just wanted to say, as a member of that board, that we support this bill. We support the extension of the ALS board, as well as the provision to make landscape architects have a permanent voting seat on the board. And I am available to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Seeing no questions, thank you very much for coming forward with your testimony. We will now, believe, go to, or is there anyone else in the room to testify? Seeing no one. Anchorage, Colin Maynard, are you online? Or there
yes,
at the LIO?
Yes, I'm online.
Oh, would you introduce yourself? And your affiliation for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Colin Maynard. I am a member of the ALS board for the last 5 years, and I'm a licensed civil and structural engineer in the state of Alaska. I'm testifying on the behalf of the ALS board. We unanimously approved this bill, both parts of it, extending the board for 8 years, and making the landscape architect position permanent and voting. That person represents the board at the National Organization of Landscape Architect Registration Boards, and they provide a essential part of our board's mission. To respond to one of the earlier questions about whether we are required to meet face-to-face, do not believe we are. However, we have had some people try to call in and teleconference our meetings. Unfortunately, they can't hear very well, and it's really hard to do application review when you have to have two board members review each application and discuss that application when you're not in the same room. So we have found it much easier to operate when we're sitting in around one table rather than in three different communities. And that's my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else online that would like to testify on House Bill 48? And has anyone come into the room that wants to testify? I want to recognize that Representative Guerra has joined us. So then at this point in time, with no further public testimony, I'll close public testimony. A discussion by the committee. No committee discussion. Representative Guerra, can you read the fiscal note?
Yes.
For HB 48 into the record?
Sure. Yes, Mr. Chair. We have fiscal note number one for House Bill 48, which states that in FY 18 there's a $29,600 fiscal note that extends through 2023, and those will be paid through designated general funds. And that, I believe, is the only fiscal note.
Thank you. Are any questions on the fiscal note? Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, can I have a motion to move the bill? Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I'd like to move House Bill 4830-LS0300/A from committee with attached fiscal note and committee recommendations.
Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, HB 4830-LS0300/A will move from House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note, and we'll take a brief at ease for signing the papers. We'll come back to order. The second bill up today is House Bill 24, listing U47700 as a controlled substance. And here to present HB 24 is the sponsor, Representative Millett, and her aide, Grace Abbott. Would you come to the table, please? Introduce yourself for the record. And go ahead, and if people are answering questions, please just state your name ahead of time so the secretary can get the two female voices separated.
Sure. Thank you. For the record, my name is Sharice Millett, representative for House District 25, and with me is Grace Abbott, and we are here to present House Bill 24. House Bill 24 came to us this fall through the governor's office. One of the things that has been identified in our ongoing opioid crisis is that the combination of the opioid and synthetic additives to the drug are making our opioid problem even more deadly. U47700 on the street, it's called Pink. It's an additive that is being cut into heroin, any other drug that you can add to it. U47700 is an incredibly potent synthetic drug. Sometimes it's seven times the potency of morphine. It's leading to a whole new realm of danger to an ongoing problem that we're all facing in our communities. U47700, I'm just going to start calling it pink because it's easier. There's no medical use for that drug. It has no medical value. That's why we're here today. It's easily made, it's easily processed, and unfortunately it's easy to obtain through the internet. You can go on a variety of websites and type in pink and they will sell it to you, and you are not breaking the law by getting that drug to the state of Alaska. Law enforcement is seeing a rise in overdoses with pink added to the substance that that our folks are overdosing on. So this bill puts it on the drug schedule as a 1A drug. It's already there on the federal registry. As we go forward, there's a lot of drugs that are going to be produced and going that are already being produced that are going to need to, at some point, be put on the schedule. One of the ideas that has been generated from this bill is looking at what the federal government does when they have drugs that have no medical reason or no medical purpose. They have a regulatory authority to put those on the federal registry. It might be something in the future that our body should think about doing. I'm amazed every time I talk to public safety about the ease and the drug process and changing one ingredient in a synthetic drug that makes it legal. We're going to see a lot more of that. We saw it during the spice crisis. The formulas were changed for spice, even though they weren't in our drug schedule. We weren't anticipating those opportunities for people to change the combination of drugs. So it's just a thought as we go forward. It's tough to do in this bill. I think the governor and his administration is looking for a way of making it a regulatory process for putting drugs on the schedule so they don't legislatively have to come to us every time we have this drug. And I think tramadol is another one that came out of the Controlled Substance Advisory Committee. So I appreciate you hearing this bill. We have folks online that can talk to you about really the immediate danger of pink and how it's affecting our communities and affecting folks that already are in crisis and using opioids. But thank you.
Any questions for the sponsor? Representative
Gutter. Thank you. Thank you, Representative. In your statement, you said we talked about being able to do this regulatorily. Didn't this body pass something similar to that a few years ago? Was it a different schedule? Or because I've talked with a couple other members, it's like, haven't we done that already?
So, through the chair, this is Representative Cherise Millett. I'm not sure. What we did pass is we have the Controlled Substance Advisory Committee that goes through and regularly reviews drugs that are, you know, don't have a medical purpose or they're found through public safety, and they recommend for us. They recommend putting those drugs on the schedule. And that's actually where pink came from, and I think tramadol was the other substance they had. So I'm not sure of any other way of putting a drug on the schedule other than through legislation.
Oh, just follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we have this one is number 82 on the list, and every time there's a molecule manipulated in the formula, we have to do this. Certainly look forward to a time when we can do this administratively, give somebody the authority to get this done faster.
Chair, this is Representative Miller. I agree with you, Representative Guttenberg. I think that we're going to see in the future more drugs of this nature that, again, have no medical purpose but are being introduced into our communities and, you know, causing, you know, even a larger crisis than we already have now.
Mr. Chair.
And then Kawasaki, and then I'm
going to turn the thanks, Representative Millett. Couple of questions. What are all the ramifications of making something a Schedule 1A controlled substance. I take it that makes it a certain level of crime. Are there ways to, with a doctor's permission or something? I mean, I know on this one there's never going to be any doctor's permission to use it because there's no medical necessity, but what are the other ramifications of putting something on 1A? Does that mean you could make it legal if a doctor made it legal, or does it just simply put it on the sort of criminal drug list?
Through the chair, this is Representative Miller. I'm going to have the Department of Law and Casey Schroeder is online, I believe, to answer that question so she can walk you through the purposes of having it on the schedule as a 1A and what the I'm assuming you're asking about the criminal ramifications.
Thank you, through the chair. Casey, this is Representative Guerra. My question really is, I guess, what are all the ramifications of making something a 1A controlled substance? Does it just put it on the sort of list of things that then can be prosecuted as a crime, or are there other ramifications for putting something on the 1A list?
If you're talking, we can't hear you.
Not online. Who are you talking to?
Did I just get set up, Representative?
No.
Nobody
again.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. I have some simple penalties I can walk you through that I can point out. Simple possession would be a misdemeanor. Distribution of less than a gram will be a Class C felony. Larger than a gram would be a Class B felony. So those are the.
Representative Seaton.
Thanks. Just for everybody's information, we have online the Alaska Crime Lab, Controlled Substance Advisory Committee, the Department of Law, Alaska State Troopers, and we have Narcotic Drug Treatment Center for members' information if they want to address questions.
Through the chair.
Representative Kerr.
Thank you. Is there somebody from the Department of Law online?
Mr. Henderson, Rob Henderson. You there?
Through the chair, this is Robert Henderson from the Department of Law.
Thank you. Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Yeah. Mr. Henderson, so obviously don't want to make this more complex than it is, but other than what are the other ramifications, if there are any? I just need to know this because we pass these bills all the time. You add something onto the controlled substance list, in this case a 1A, it becomes a crime for possession or distribution. Is there any other ramification of putting something on the controlled substance list besides that?
Through the chair, Representative, so one thing to keep in mind when is that a Schedule 1A under Alaska law is different than a Schedule 1 for the federal schedules. In Alaska, there are drugs on the Schedule 1A that have a medical purpose, but the way we schedule it in Alaska are the 1A drugs are those that are so dangerous or are so susceptible to abuse that we put them as high as we can. And then generally speaking, what we're talking about is the criminal schedule. So both in Title 11 and the possession and distribution, but also Title 28, so DUI. So driving under the influence of a controlled substance is a DUI.
And that's it. Those are the only ramifications of putting on the list, and I take it with maybe some of these other drugs you might be able to, I don't know if there is some other use, maybe you could get a prescription for them. I'm just curious, that's all. I know you're not going to get a prescription for this.
Through the chair, Representative, there are some other controlled substances on a 1A that can be prescribed, and then the other implication of that would be things like the prescription drug monitoring program and some of the other regulatory aspects of prescription drugs. But for purposes of this drug, it would really be just to attach criminal liability to its possession or distribution.
And one final question, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you. And then the other question, Mr. Henderson, is so this is illegal under federal law on their drug list. So a crime under federal law to possess or sell. Right now, Would local law enforcement or state law enforcement not be allowed to arrest somebody and then, I guess, refer them over to the feds? Or what is allowed now for law enforcement?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett. So the local law enforcement would be able to investigate and refer charges over to the federal government when this drug is criminalized under federal law. But our local law enforcement is really charged with enforcing state law. That's not to say that some of our law enforcement work collaboratively with our federal partners, but their main charge is to enforce federal law.
Just one more.
Sure, follow up.
And just until we pass this, Mr. Henderson, would local law enforcement be allowed to arrest somebody and then refer that person over to federal authorities?
Through the chair, Representative, that question I'm going to answer and then defer to my DPS partner, who I believe is also online. But when you ask, can they arrest, they legally could if they had authorization from or permission from the U.S. Attorney's Office.
That's good enough for me. Thanks.
Okay. Are there any further questions of the committee? Representative Kawasaki.
So, thank you. This is a similar line of questioning for the Department of Law. The Department of Law sent, Attorney General sent a memo dated February 1. And so I guess I'm just not clear about that answer to the question whether a state trooper can stop those who are distributing the drug and assist in medical, or stop those who are distributing the drug. Basically, it says in this memo, alas, if we pass this, and it is in a Schedule 1A in Alaska statute, that Alaska will allow state law enforcement to stop those. So I guess, barring that, can a state trooper just go and arrest somebody based on just distribution or possession?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, that question, I will tell you, legally, we have troopers who work with federal law enforcement, and they work collaboratively, and they can make arrests for violation of federal drug laws. But the typical Alaska State Trooper is charged with enforcing state law. So unless something's a violation of state law, that is not going to be a priority for them in their investigation. So it depends on the precise question I get. Legally, could they? If they're working in conjunction with their federal partners, then yes.
So follow-up?
Follow-up.
So a downtown patrol officer, City of Juneau, could do it on their own without the support of without this law? Or a village public safety officer in Queethluck?
We always use Queethluck.
Antioch?
Through the chair, Representative, I would say not without prior discussions with the U.S. Attorney's Office, because there would be no mechanism in which to enter that into the system, into the federal criminal justice system, without some type of prior discussion with the U.S. Attorney's Office. So if a local law enforcement officer came in contact with U47700 in conjunction with their normal duties, an arrest is unlikely to be made, in fact, would not be made, and most likely what would happen is that would be referred to the federal law enforcement.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have another question, though.
Sure. Another question, Representative Kawasaki.
What was my question? Actually, I guess I don't have a question anymore, but I did have a comment to make, just sort of a I think we've passed number 72 to number 81 so far, and since I've been a member, I know you've been a member, you've passed one of these statutes for spice, and then there was the bath salts, and I think I agree with Representative Guttenberg that there's got to be an easier way to do this than always adding like one bill at a time and have some sort of regulatory mechanism. You know, we have license plate bills that always come up, and this is sort of the license plate bill within the criminal statute. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any further questions of the committee? Okay, seeing no questions, I believe We are up at public testimony. Great. Okay, thank you. Do we have anybody in the room who would like to testify? Seeing nobody, is there anybody online who would like to testify? Okay, sounds like we do not have anybody. So with that, we'll close. So we'll open public testimony. Seeing no public testimony, we'll close public testimony. Okay, at this time, I'd like to offer two amendments to HB 24. I move amendment number one, which is A.1.
Objection.
Okay, let's take a brief at ease here to make sure everybody's got that. House Finance Committee. We're back on record here. So everybody has two amendments before you. And if I could ask the sponsor's aide to come up. And thank you. So we've got Grace Abbott here with us. And amendment number one, I move amendment number one, which is A.1 Martin.
Yes.
And amendment number, thank you for the objection. We've got an objection for the purposes of discussion from Representative Kawasaki. And amendment number one is a technical amendment that corrects a spelling error. There's a missing Z in there. We've got the sponsor's aide, Ms. Abbott, available for questions. Are there any questions of the committee?
I withdraw my objection.
Thank you. Are there any further objections? Seeing no objection, amendment number one is adopted. And next we have, I move amendment number two. It's marked amendment A.2 Martin. And is there an objection?
Objection.
Okay, we've got an objection for purposes of discussion. Thank you, Representative Wilson. Amendment number two classifies tramadol and related substances as Schedule 4A controlled substance. Ms. Abbott, do you have anything to add?
Thank you, through the chair, and for the record, Grace Abbott, staff to Representative Millett. This follows along the same recommendation from the Controlled Substances Advisory Committee within their packet of recommendations, along with scheduling PINK as a Schedule 1A controlled substance. They similarly recommended that tramadol be scheduled and related substances be scheduled as a 4A, and so this would follow that recommendation. It's also in line with the way that the federal schedule has read since 2014. Once again, Assistant Attorney General Robert Henderson, who I believe is the chair of CSAC, can speak to perhaps the advisory committee's decision-making behind this addition.
We've got two questions, Representative Kawasaki and then Wilson.
Thank you. This is for just whoever can answer whether tramadol has a medical function, and then what's the difference between Schedule 1A and 4A?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, once again, Grace Abbott, aide to Representative Millett. the differences between the schedules is that as they go from 6 to 1, they get more severe in nature. Tramadol does have a medical purpose. It's a painkiller, pain reliever, and certainly under a doctor's prescription, it can be used properly to prevent pain or to numb. But under the 4A category, it has some consequences if people are selling it illicitly or providing it to people under the age of 19.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So is the only way to be able to get this drug is through a prescription?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, once again, Grace Abbott for the record. That is my belief. Obviously, if I'm misspeaking, I hope that Mr. Henderson would pipe in and say otherwise. But I believe it is a prescription drug.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
So isn't it already illegal to sell a prescribed medication?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's beyond my scope of understanding, but this putting it on the schedule does allow certain consequences for dealing for criminal purposes as well as providing it to people under the age of 19. But for further criminal implications, perhaps Assistant Attorney General Henderson would be the right person to ask.
Mr. Henderson, are you online?
I am.
If you could take a stab at that.
So through the chair, Representative Wilson, the question was, is it already against the law? That would be, yes, it is already against federal law. It is not, it's not in violation of Alaska law because it's not a controlled substance as we have those defined. And so by doing this, we actually make the federal law and the state law consistent.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So I can sell any of my prescriptions I want for profit as long as it's not a Schedule 1 to 6?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it depends on the prescription, and it depends on if it's a controlled substance either under federal law or state law. There are some drugs that are prescription that would not fall under Title 11. But we try to make those the federal law and the state law consistent.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
Wow, I'm just seeing a different kind of profit here. because this kind of, you know, Mr. Chairman, this kind of changes the bill. So this kind of just got dropped on us, so we didn't even know this was here. This is kind of away from what I thought the bill was. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. It's just, you know, I don't understand some of these different medication. I always thought it was illegal to take a prescription and then sell the pills out of that prescription. So just so that I understand correctly, so just talking about this one, because I'm sure there's so many others. So if I were to get a prescription for this particular drug and I wanted to, you know, sell it because I didn't need the rest of them, currently, except for federal law, obviously, currently this, back to the Juneau police, saw me selling it to someone else, could not arrest me for doing that.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, if you were selling tramadol today, it would not be a violation of state law because it's not a controlled substance.
Wow. Okay, follow up?
Follow up.
So what makes this one so drastic then? Because obviously, I'm assuming it's been out there for a while. Why all of a sudden now do we need to put it on a schedule? I mean, what does it, you know, what does it take to get, you know, on this schedule, because you just said there was a one through six. So what makes this one to where it falls, should fall under Schedule 4, and what issues have we had with this particular drug in Alaska that we would want to make this move?
So through the chair, Representative Wilson, tramadol is, it's been around a while. And it first came to the attention of the Controlled Substance Advisory Committee about 18 months ago. When we had a representative from Western Alaska testify to the committee about the abuse that was occurring with tramadol. It then came back to the committee when we received a letter last fall from the Alaska Pharmacists Associations requesting that we recommend the scheduling of tramadol And in part, that's because of the inconsistency that was that existed between federal law and state law, that individuals were able to obtain tramadol either legally or illegally, but state law enforcement and the state law enforcement wasn't able to interdict or to address that issue.
And one last follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
A follow-up.
So if we go upon that anything could be sold or misused, or wouldn't we pretty much any drug that's manufactured automatically fall underneath 1 through 6, just with that philosophy that it could be misused or it could be sold for other purposes?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's a large policy question for the legislature. You know, when the Controlled Substances Advisory Committee discussed this, we recognized that the current scheduling process is not as nimble or flexible as some other states, and for example, the federal government, where they can regulate drugs and then the Congress either ratifies or adopts that regulation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. We've got four questions. First, Representative Guerra, then Ortiz, Kawasaki, and Guttenberg. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, but would the way this is worded, would just, did you say that just tramadol without any of these other substances would become a 4A drug, and it's not a 4A drug right now?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I don't have the amendment in front of me, but what the testimony that we received and the information we received from the Controlled Substances Advisory Committee was tramadol. It would make sense, though, to include those related substances.
Just through the chair.
Follow up.
I'm no scientist, but as a patient, I broke my ribs last year, and I did not want a high-level opiate. I didn't want the sort of Vicodins or any of that stuff, and I wanted like the lowest level painkiller the doctor would recommend, and the doctor gave me tramadol. I'm just curious. I'm really just thinking out loud. If I had a tramadol and then I had a friend who was in pain, not that I've ever done this, but I had a friend who was in pain and had nothing, and I handed that person a tramadol, would I then have committed a crime?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, that's a difficult question. It actually implicates several different criminal statutes. The distribution of a controlled substance, depending on the type of controlled substance, is a crime. And then there are various justification defenses that would relieve that person of criminal liability, for example, necessity.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. We've got a question from Representative Ortiz, then Kawasaki and Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Grace, getting back to Representative Kawasaki's question, his question was around the difference between something put on a Schedule 1 versus a Schedule 4, and you indicated that there is more severity. Is that like severity of complications with the drug itself causing more danger? Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, once again, Grace Abbott for the record. That is what I was referring to, both dangerousness of the drug itself, and then it follows that the severity of punishments increases along with the schedule of the drug. And once again, our friend at the Assistant Attorney General's office would be the perfect person to ask what kind of penalties are associated with each of the scheduled drugs.
Yes. So in layman's terms,
In
layman's terms, the U47700 is less dangerous than tramadol.
Pardon me, through the chair, Grace Abbott. It is U47700 is more severe. Right, one being the worst, six being the least worst.
Thank you. That's where I was.
Okay, thank you. I also want to point out, just I know some criminal questions have come up, and I just want folks to know that we've got on the line available Captain Michael Duxbury. He's a statewide drug enforcement person from the Alaska State Troopers. And so with that, we'll move on to the next question here, which is Representative Kawasaki and then Guttenberg.
thank you. This is for, again, for law. Does changing the schedule or adding a drug into the schedule change any prescriptive authority for any physicians, nurse practitioners, things like that?
Through the chair, Representative, if I would defer that question to Dr. Butler, if he is online, or to the Board of Pharmacy, I would tell you that I do not believe that it changes their prescription authority.
Is there anybody else online who'd like to address the question? Seeing none, do you have a follow-up, Representative Kawasaki?
Wanted an answer to the question, but I guess I'll just lay it on the record that I do have a little bit of concern about this amendment coming in this late, and I haven't done my research on it, and I know that tramadol is a useful device that gets prescribed fairly often, I think, nowadays, and so I just obviously that's ripe for abuse, but I'm not sure what we do by adding this into Schedule 4. It may complicate things down the line, and I kind of wanted an answer to that question. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you. We've got a question from Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the Department of Law, I heard you say, if I had it right, that some, at the federal level, some organization puts it on their list, and then at some point Congress approves or disapproves of that. Of it, and that makes it official, or it establishes it. Is that the process that you were talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that is correct. So under federal law, the DEA actually has regulatory authority, so they can pass emergency regulations, and then Congress, I believe it's 18 months, although it could be 24 months, they have a specific amount of time in which Congress has to act, and I believe the process under federal law is that if they choose not to act, then it falls off the controlled substance schedules. They have to affirmatively ratify or adopt that emergency regulation.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair,
Representative Guttenberg,
in that period from the time it's put on the list to the time Congress does or does not adopt it, is there any difference in the ability to enforce? Is it diminished until the time? What I'm trying to do is come up with a way that maybe mimics the way the feds do it here so we can facilitate a faster process for doing things like this. For the Department of Law, have you looked at that, that we could do some mini version of that here? Is that be possible?
So through the chair, Representative, the Controlled Substance Advisory Committee has discussed this. In fact, at the same meeting in which the Controlled Substance Advisory Committee recommended the scheduling of both U-47700 and tramadol, we also affirmatively adopted the recommendation from the Opioid Drug Task Force, which was to create a regulatory body to address this issue that's being discussed. And so there are several different ways to do it. But I believe that with a clear delegation of authority from the legislature to a regulatory body, it would be feasible. And then to answer your precise question, then yes, that regulation, that emergency regulation, would have the full effect of the statute.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So was there an actual recommendation, or was the dialogue took place without any action? Did they advance anything? Did they have anything in writing that would help us facilitate that, or was it just a committee dialogue?
Through the chair, Representative, it was just a committee dialogue that it was the first opportunity for the committee to review the Opioid Task Force recommendations and to give that some thought. So it is at something that we're actively considering, and in fact the Controlled Substance Advisory Committee is meeting next week, and I anticipate that this conversation will continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there further questions? I'm going to withdraw the amendments, and I think we do want to try and move the bill along. This is something that we want to take care of in terms of the original bill, and along the process we can work on the tramadol here. So at this point, Representative Millett.
This is Representative Millett, for the record. I think for further discussion, moving the bill would be appropriate. I know that there's a companion bill on the Senate side, and so they'll give a little longer time to look at tramadol and the effects of putting on the schedule. But I agree that at this point, if the committee is uncomfortable, U47700, though, is something I think that needs immediate action. It's currently being distributed in our communities as we speak, and so the risk of slowing something down, I worry that we're not giving the tools to the public safety officers that they're asking for.
Okay, thank you, Representative Millett. With that, the amendment number 2 has been withdrawn, and so we will now move over to Representative Guerra.
Thank you.
And do you have a question still, and then we'll move to the fiscal notes.
I do. Representative Millett, just obviously this bill is going to leave here, and then somebody's going to try and insert tramadol possibly later on. So I just, why was this introduced? What is the big public health danger on tramadol that we should know about?
Through the chair, this is Representative Millett. So, Representative Guerra, if you talk to the folks on the Controlled Substance Abuse Committee, one of the things is they're seeing a higher propensity for folks to abuse tramadol, and it's now one of those, again, we see a designer drug every now and then come through and abuse the quantity of taking tramadol. As you've experienced, you can overdose on tramadol. You can overdose on Tylenol, right? So their thought was that they're seeing a higher usage in the street terms of it rather than as a prescription. So it was one of the drugs that was highlighted, that they're seeing folks go in and ask for prescriptions because it has a value on the streets and being sold, and it wasn't on the schedule. And so you can't, if someone's buying, 50 pills of tramadol and taking them or smoking them or adding it to something else, it becomes a dangerous substance. And we're seeing that with the things that are already on the schedule that they're trying to combat. You've got codeine, got morphine. Folks are finding ingenious ways to combine drugs and, elicit a higher high, and this is one of the ones that came to the attention of the committee. And I don't think they take their putting a drug on the schedule very lightly. I think it's, reactionary most times, as it is with pink, identifying what pink was and going forward and talking about the dangers of it being out there on the streets.
Thank you. Through the chair, just finally.
Representative Kerr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The underlying bill makes sense. If I guess I would ask you to keep us apprised of, information that justifies if we're going to see this tramadol thing in the limbo file when it comes to the House floor. I mean, the underlying bill addresses a drug that has no beneficial use. Tramadol, at least I'm no expert, but the doctor who helped me when I broke my ribs told me that's the least of the serious prescriptions they could have given me. That's all I know, but I guess we'll want real information and not have to make a spot decision when we're on the House floor.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, Representative Guerra, I'll be happy to bring by all the information that I have from the committee, the advisory committee, and I'll make sure that you can get all the information that you need. I think it's important to look at the other drugs on the schedule so you can see what else is put on there through the years. I mean, if you look at all of our schedules, I mean, there's things on there that you wouldn't think would be dangerous or would have a street value, that amazingly enough, again, people are creative out there and eliciting a high, you know, at some point I imagine we'll be talking about mouthwash. There are things that are happening with folks that I couldn't have imagined or I couldn't have thought of. I mean, so I would be more than happy to provide the information to you.
Okay, any further questions? Seeing none, Representative Garrett, would you please walk us through the 4-0 fiscal notes on HB 24?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I have five of them. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have five fiscal notes. Fiscal note number one for House Bill 24, dated February 3rd, 2017, is a zero fiscal note from the Department of Corrections. Fiscal note number two is a zero fiscal note dated also February 3rd, 2017, from the Department of Health and Social Services. Fiscal note number three, dated the same date, another zero fiscal note from the Department of Law, the Criminal Division. Fiscal note number four, same date, another zero fiscal note. And that's from the Department of Public Safety, and then that's from the Troopers Division, and then from the Department of Public Safety's Statewide Support Division. Fiscal note number five, also dated February 3rd, 2003, is a zero fiscal note, and I guess folks can add up all five fiscal notes cost and figure that out.
Okay, we've got two questions, Representative Kawasaki and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that the agencies have all delivered us zero fiscal notes, but I just want to say that if we're adding something to a drug schedule and we actually our intent is to see prosecutions and arrests on people that are distributing these drugs, that it just can't be a zero fiscal note. I just have a problem with seeing zero fiscal notes. So, I mean, it's an indeterminate at best, but I mean, I'd really hate to say that this is not going to cost anything down the road where we know it will if it's done correctly. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, mine follows along with my colleague to the left is that, and especially on fiscal note number one, so it's my understanding that this would be a felony, and so if it's a felony, somebody's going to get locked up. At $149.62, which that just depends upon where they're put in, how many, and I don't know if somebody can answer this question, so how many potential people does it take to be locked up to get a fiscal note, not a zero? I mean, I'm sincerely asking the question because, again, if there's not an issue, then the bill wouldn't be in front of us. Obviously, there's an issue. So what, you know, would make these, you know, fiscal notes, maybe if public safety are the only, it's the only ones that are online, maybe the question would be to them, how many potential arrests would it take before you would write a fiscal note and not have it at zero? Are they still online?
Is anybody online who would like to take a crack at that?
For the record, this is Captain Michael Duxbury, the Statewide Drug Enforcement, and through the chair. Ma'am, the thing that we see in the state of Alaska is a very popular thing to describe right now as the opioid problem, when in fact it is the multi-drug use problem. And the reason that we came to the table with this drug and asking for it to be scheduled, very similar to other drugs that are scheduled and are often prescribed on a regular basis, Oxycontin, Oxycodone, which are all prescribed but are also scheduled drugs. We're looking to reduce the ability of people to abuse it and send it through the mail. We're seeing it online right now, even though it is a prescription drug. We see it sold online, and we're looking to deter that. We're detecting it more and more in other drug seizures that we're making. So putting it as a zero fiscal note wasn't the intention to deceive anyone. It was the we're having a problem. We see a lot of this stuff in conjunction. We can't seize it because it's not meet a federal threshold, but it is a problem. We're seeing the problem, and it wasn't illegal in the state realm, but we're seeing it in conjunction with other drugs being shipped throughout the state. So fiscal, the zero fiscal note was not that it was not happening, but that it was happening in conjunction with stuff that we are already enforcing, where we were trying to get a handle on it, so the message is sent. Like other prescription drugs, like I said, in the oxycodones, the oxycontins, and some of the other prescription drugs that everybody takes for pain, we were looking for the scheduling to take place so that we could have a deterrence out there, because the three parts of my job are, I like as a state trooper to reduce the amount of bad choices that children have to make and when these things become available to the extreme, and that's what we're looking to do.
Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up?
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you for making my point, because I think that's exactly what we're sitting here wondering is, one of two things are happening. They are selling a variety of drugs, kind of like a drugstore, so this won't change the same arrests you're already making. But I have a hard time believing that you won't be making more arrests. And I'm saying that's a bad thing if this goes on the schedule, and therefore there would be, you know, some kind of information to tell us, not just from public safety's view, but from law, who's going to be prosecuting, the public defenders who are going to be defending them, and correction. So maybe this question is to you, Mr. Chairman, not to the department, because they just made our case. Do you review these fiscal notes as the chairman, you know, co-chairing, and send them, can you send them back and say this doesn't make sense that we would see everything zero? Because I love Representative Dugan when he was on here. He hated indeterminate fiscal notes. But on things like this, I don't know how they wouldn't be indeterminate, because you honestly, at the very beginning, would not know how much. But I think zero sends the wrong message that we're really not doing anything and we don't expect any future costs. So I personally, on these, I would rather see indeterminate than zeros, because I don't think we're really given the true picture in our climate today where we're not having the money, but this would be important enough that it still should be passed because it does do damage out there.
Sure, and let's take a quick at ease. I'd like to check with staff and find out what exactly the process is on this here. So at ease for a moment. Okay, we're going to come back on record here. And we've got with us Mr. David Teal. And Mr. Teal, if you could address the question regarding fiscal notes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division. And I think the confusion over a zero fiscal note here is that you're looking at it as information, which it is. But a fiscal note is primarily a request for funding. So the department, in their explanation, is saying there will be costs, we will enforce this, but because it's part of our other enforcement duties, we're not requesting any additional money to enforce this particular drug. It doesn't mean there's no cost, it just means that they don't want money added to their budget to do what they're already doing, which is enforcing drug abuse in general.
So I've got three questions. Representative Ortiz, and then Guerra, and then Wilson. Okay. Representative Guerra, did you still have a question? Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we can take this fiscal note to heart, and so next year when they come back and they need more money because they actually did arrest people and they actually put them in jail, we can remind them that they lost their opportunity to put it in the fiscal note.
Mr. Teal?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, you can remind them of that. And they did, in fact, lose the opportunity to put it in a fiscal note. That doesn't mean they don't have the opportunity to submit an increment next year and say things are not as we expected. We do have significant costs. We have, you know, we prosecuted, whatever, 40 people. We've been successful. They're now both a public safety problem and a corrections problem, and for all we know, a health and social services problem. And you may get increments for this. They don't know that, and therefore, in this first year, they're not requesting money through the fiscal note process. But again, increments are a different issue.
Mr. Chairman,
hello?
I don't know whether Mr. Till can answer this. Someone else can. Do we know for this drug how many arrests there has been underneath the federal law for this drug? Does anybody keep track?
Is there anybody online who?
Okay, it was worth a try. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Next up, we've got Representative Guerra, did you? And then Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm going to say just for myself, and I could be standing on an island on this, I'm sort of done with this. These things cost money. And so at the district attorney's office, they're declining more and more prosecutions, letting more and more criminals go free because they don't have enough prosecutors. And everybody's saying, cut the budget, cut the budget, cut the budget. We're getting that from the public. It's been going on for years in this building. And I will say, for myself, at some point, you can't pretend you can keep cutting the public safety budget the way it's been going on in this building. So when next year they decide we actually want to enforce our criminal laws and we don't want to keep dropping the number of prosecutions, and I know a number of people in this building are concerned about this right now, but when they say we need an extra $200,000 for prosecutors or whatever it is, I guess I'm just not going to be there jumping up and down with everybody else saying we got to keep cutting the budget. There are ramifications, and the ramification here is we don't have enough prosecutors. And this is going to make things better in that we can arrest people more easily for this drug. It's going to make things worse in that there will be other prosecutions that won't go forward. And at some point we have to grapple with this budget and realize that you can't just magically say we're cutting everything and make the problems disappear. So I guess when next year they come in and they say we actually needed a couple extra prosecutors because we're shortchanging ourselves, I'm going to be receptive to it. I hope they do come in next year and ask for more prosecutors.
Okay, thank you, Representative Guerra. Next up, we've got Representative Pruitt and then Representative Seaton.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, you know, when we talk about this particular drug that we're adding to this, I think it's probably important to recognize that we're not creating a whole new set of drugs where someone's going to be just introduced to this. This is, we were probably going to deal with this person in some capacity, whether it was this drug or another drug that was very similar to it. So this, I don't want to exactly say that it would probably be a wash, but you're still dealing with, I don't know that we're, I think we're kind of getting into something that they're probably, it's probably not really a relevant point. This person, we were either going to have, they were going to cost us money at some point in time, whether it was because we found another drug on them or we showed up at another point in time to, as with the coroner, to take them off. And so I think we were already going to have to pay for this person. That's, I think, where the zero comes in. Well, we were going to deal with this individual. It's not a brand new thing. It's not, we're going to, new interaction. When you've gotten to the point where you're using this drug, you have done all of the other lower drugs to get to this. This is a nasty substance. It's your, and read the documentation that was given by the sponsor. This is stuff that you're, they're searching on the dark web to get this stuff from China. And this is nasty stuff. It's not a new introduction. They are truly addicts at this point in time. And so we were going to deal with them in some capacity. Different discussion than really what the previous representative was discussing, but I think we just need to pass this thing out of here.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the representative that was a member on the statewide opioid task force meeting every 2 weeks this last year and the interim, it's a significant problem, and the question here is there another drug that if we don't put it on the schedule, we are allowing it to be basically freely distributed, it's non-criminal, and we get people hooked on opioid drugs by not having it on the Class 1 schedule. So that is more important, and that we will see more people addicted to opioids if we allow addictive substances that get them hooked on opioids to be freely distributed and not be a criminal offense. So I think that we should look at it from that way instead of the way that, oh, we're going to arrest somebody for distributing this and then it's going to cost us money. It actually may save us some addictions from taking place in the first place because the drugs are not as available throughout the state because they're not legal. Right now, without it being on the schedule, it's legal to distribute this substance, which could cause addictions and get people on heroin and other things. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. If it is the will of the committee, I would like to entertain a motion on HB 24.
I'll move it.
Okay. Mr. Representative Pruitt?
Sure. I'll move House Bill 23 out of committee with accompanying fiscal notes and recommendations.
Object.
As amended. That's right.
Object.
Objection by Representative Wilson.
And I'll remove my objection. This is one of the few drugs that falls in its own categories. It's bad. It shouldn't be here. But kind of following up on the couple discussions we've had here, one, we have to get honest fiscal notes. I think that was really what the discussion was about. Maybe for this one, it may be the same. But, we are the Finance Committee, and we have our subcommittees, and we need to know whether or not somebody's going to have to come back, because of that. But I also want to be careful because we're talking about possibly adding other drugs. And codeine used to be readily available until people started misusing it. And I had a child who had bad asthma, and it was the only thing that worked. And then we had a sign for the pharmacy that was bad enough. Then we had to do something else to where it finally got it to where it wasn't available, and she went through her own drama and couldn't, an illness because other things didn't work because somebody didn't use the product for what it's worth. So for us as legislators, if we think we can stop people from using things in a manner that they shouldn't by putting it onto a list, then we're not into reality. And that's what concerns me more than anything else. There are certain ones like this that are just no-brainers. But others, as they come before us, I think we have to remember that we can't stop people from doing bad things. But I also want to make sure the message is sent that as we get, everybody's trying not to have a fiscal note on their bills.
But, you know, we really want to take a close look at the budget and be very diligent in what we do. We need to make sure that we're clear about that. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I do withdraw my objection.
Okay, thank you. Are there any further objections?
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Seaton?
Just a point of clarification. Was the motion version A as amended?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is. It can be now. Was it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Okay, and with that, HB 24, which is 30-LS0260/A, moves from the House Committee as amended, with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal notes. And with that, we will take a brief at ease to allow folks to sign the bill sheet, and I will pass the gavel back to Representative Seaton. I'd like to call us back to order. Thank you, Ms. Teal, for coming to the table. I'm going to describe the new operating budget amendment system to the committee members. Since I expect that we will take up a few subcommittee reports tomorrow, this seems like an opportune time to hear about the new system. Members have on their desks the subcommittee reports for the Office of the Governor, the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and the Department of Revenue. Mr. Teal, please put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division. To talk about a new amendment system we're implementing this year. The first question you may have is, why is there a new system at all? What was wrong with the old one? It worked. It did work. But the process was cumbersome, not necessarily for legislators or staff, because I think the process is much the same under both the old and new systems. They simply prepare an amendment at the subcommittee level. Unfortunately, many of those amendments contained technical errors, that which we refer to or define as structural errors. The agency, the allocation, the appropriation are misnamed. They try to remove money that doesn't exist. They lack line item detail. And they make us do a lot of guessing about what the amendment really meant and where we're what we're supposed to do with the money. In addition to that, the co-chair had to track the amendment system or the amendments in a spreadsheet because there were many of them, a lot of near duplicates, so on. So that required keying in the amendments again and by a different person. Of course, when I say co-chair, I mean co-chair staff. I don't think the co-chairs actually did that. But and then, of course, as amendments were passed, legislative finance had to rekey the amendments into the budget system. So there were really three times that we were entering the same data. And the fourth problem was that oftentimes proposed language hadn't gone through legal services and didn't meet their standards. So we had decided long before you came in, Mr. Chairman, that there was something wrong with the inefficiencies, and we were beginning to prepare a new amendment system. So what we have in that amendment system is drop-down menus. You can reach the amendment system from our webpage and then just go to operating and drop down to amendment systems. And it will give you a screen like this. So you can then add an amendment quite easily. Your staff should be able to do this. Well, that's nice. We'll have to retry that and see what... Maybe that's what happens when we sit too long with... Oops, I'm moving the mouse while I'm trying to enter things here.
And what's his password?
Well, you can probably see that too. I would sign in as legislative finance, but we can't add amendments. Only people on finance can add amendments. And I think I was kicked off, timed out, actually, which is a good thing. But you can see that we now have drop-down menus, which help you avoid technical issues. And since you're closing out revenue tomorrow, let's just pick revenue, and just taxation works fine. Tax division, and if you want a decrement, then you're describing this. We don't need to enter anything much there. Section 1, and you pick your line item, and you pick your fund code, and you should be able to go add an explanation to it. You can bring that in from Word. You can type it in here if you want. Then you should be able to save it, and it says you got an error. Your expenditure total does not equal funding, which is true because I entered a 2 instead of a minus 40 here. So now it's going to say it's invalid. You're removing more money than is on a line. Okay, that's because I tried to take money from the miscellaneous line. You can't do that because there's no money there. So I guess the point here is that the system will help you avoid technical errors. And again, you're moving money that's not in the fund code. You're trying to remove school funds. You can't do that. They don't exist here. So you probably really meant general funds. You shouldn't be experimenting like this. You should be looking at your subcommittee book and figuring out what you want to enter. You shouldn't be randomly picking fund codes and things that cause you to have to go back and edit. But once you get an amendment correctly, you can then look at it. I should have that amendment now under, right where I put it, revenue and taxation, tax division. Okay, and there it is. I can edit it. I can take a look at it. I can delete it. I can attach backup to it. Any PDF can be attached to the amendment, including a legal services language amendment, if that's what it is. You can copy it if you have similar amendments. You can share it with all members if you choose, or majority members if you choose that. If you're a minority legislator, that will say minority members and say. So this is like CAPSIS. You can essentially share the amendments with others and get them to co-sponsor them. And of course, you can let finance view it. What that means is you're sending it to us. We will help you with transaction titles, hopefully catch any errors that are there, edit your explanation if you want us to. So theoretically, we get better amendments out of this. You can submit it. Once you submit it, that becomes a live amendment that's going to be going on. Right now, we just want to delete that one.
Once you say go to Ledge Finance or go to Finance Committee, do we still have access to it still to change it and adjust it?
Yes, we can view it, and so if your staff wants to call us, we can talk about it on the screen, edit it there, save it, and you know, do whatever needs to be done to the amendment. So hopefully we get you know, these problems of transaction titles that are not descriptive enough for our purposes will be fixed before the amendment hits the committee.
And I think the question was, if once it's submitted or shared with other committee members, can it be changed?
Oh, once it's submitted for viewing to us, yes, it can be changed. Once you click submit, then it's locked. You cannot look at it again, because we, of course, might then have an amendment that we're loading, but that you're changing, and we can't do that.
Okay.
So once it's submitted to us, it is locked up.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And the other question is, they can be shared before they're submitted with other committee members through that system or not?
Mr. Chairman, they can be shared at any time. That's just a co-sponsor, and co-sponsor, like CAPSIS, you can add your name, pull your name off of an amendment, but that's going to be between legislators' offices. We don't see that.
Thank you. And Representative Wilson had a question.
So if you're looking at positions but not PCNs within it, because there's a program, you know, and there was certain positions to it, and let's say that half of it is general funds and half of it is federal, but knowing that the federal funds can probably be put into other positions that are still within the department, can you take that salary as all general funds, knowing that the odds are the department's not going to give the federal funds back, they'll still figure out a way to utilize them, or does it have to specifically match whatever those positions are by that, you know, by those two numbers?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, you do not have to match an amendment. Like, for instance, there's a governor's amendment out there asking for new positions. You can reverse the whole thing. You can choose 10 different fund codes. So if you want to just pull the general funds, you may say, I want to take my general funds, and here you might say, I don't want to do anything with the federal funds, or however you choose as the maker of the amendment. You can pull the general fund portion of it, all of it, up to 10 fund codes. If you go beyond 10 fund codes, you probably need to call us for help, because we're going to have to enter that amendment in a different way.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
And I would assume then the best way to do that then is, would be in the explanation on why you didn't, why that wouldn't match, you know, and how, you know, maybe it was interagencies or other points of that. But within your explanation would then go why you picked whatever you did and your rationale just for that change altogether.
Through the chair, that's correct. The explanations, I think, the goal here is to have an explanation that heads off questions at the committee, because the first thing that's going to happen in committee is, well, this doesn't match something, what are you doing? And if the explanation is, I removed the general fund portion of this funding, I left the federal for these reasons, theoretically, and it saves time in committee because those questions won't need to be answered or asked.
Are there further questions? I thought it was important for us all to, not that we're going to toggle through all these ourselves necessarily, but for us to have an understanding of what the system is and kind of how it works in submitting those. Seeing no further questions, thank you. I want to describe the process that House Finance is going to use going forward to develop the operating budget. Once again, subcommittees are in the process of closing out and forwarding their recommendations to House Finance. When each department's subcommittee report is scheduled in the House Finance, the subcommittee chair will describe the subcommittee's recommendations. Then, if amendments were recommended, House Finance will take up those amendments using the Legislative Finance Amendment Report instead of the packets of amendments that were used in prior sessions. That's just what we've seen the reports as they'll be generated. House Finance will also see the statutory changes proposed by the subcommittee chairs. Those statutory changes are listed and briefly explained in the subcommittee narrative reports. And each subcommittee chair will need to transmit their statutory recommendations to each affected policy committee. We're not voting on those. Those are recommendations that come from the subcommittee. And then in certain circumstances, there will be language amendments that I will propose in addition to the subcommittee recommended amendments. Those will come with each department. As Mr. Teal mentioned, I will have two additional amendments proposed for the Department of Revenue that we will take up tomorrow, and they're included in the Ledge Finance report that you have in the file, and you should have three files on your desk. After we go through all the subcommittee reports, I will also bring forward other language amendments for the statewide items, and that'll be at the end of the process. I just want to reiterate what Mr. Teal has said, you know, in how this is going to progress. Then we will have a new committee substitute drafted at that point. This is after we incorporate the subcommittee proposals and the language amendments that will generate the CS. And once the committee substitute is before us, we will take public testimony on those amendments. After public testimony, we'll then take up round two amendments. Any additional budget amendments from House Finance Committee members. Those amendments will need to be submitted via the new operating budget amendment system. So, are there any questions at this point? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, since you did the revenue one, so I'm looking at the Department of Revenue right now. So, it actually has amendments in here. So if I were to look into Military and Veterans Affairs and I don't see any actual written up amendments, then there are no amendment. Basically, we would be, somebody would be giving the subcommittee report, but there would not be any amendments to go with it, correct? Because right here I see amendments, but I see nothing in some of these others.
There are two amendments, and those will be generated, and they'll be in the other format, I believe. Mr. Teal? I mean, we have a question.
I want to be next to Lyle.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, it might help to go again. This is a shot of our website, and what you, your staff, and the public can do is to look at the subcommittee reports. And this is as they were reported out of committee. And you'll see that the committees, and we will post these as subcommittees close out. You can see that Department of Administration and Commerce have closed out, as have the Governor, Military and Veterans Affairs, and Revenue. When they close out, we will post with the transaction detail, the narrative, etc. You also see that we post the amendment packets. It might help here if I do this, go ahead and look at revenue, where these are the amendments as they were passed out of subcommittee. There are two of them. Both, one relates to mental health and one to tax division. In addition to that, you'll see the subcommittee amendment packets. Slightly different, because this means that we now have the narrative from the subcommittee. We're ready to post the full amendment packet. So now as I look at Department of Revenue, I can see the narrative. I will then go to the transaction report, and you'll see that we now have four amendments. That's because, as the chairman said, one of them involved language, and so we're moving paternity testing money from the language section of the bill to section one. So these are your two amendments that the chair has added and that would be voted on by full committee. The attachments that you'll see, the supporting documents, would be the actual legal services amendment related to that specific amendment. So any other backup would be attached as well, which should all be in your packet. But this gives the public, all legislators, the ability to look at amendments hopefully well in advance of the time they're taken up at full committee, which I think the chairman was looking at a welcome change from past years when finance committee members were, you know, a 1:30 meeting that didn't start until 2:30, and you got some pretty warm paper right out of the copy machine that no one had seen. You will now see the amendments hopefully well in advance of the meeting.
The follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
So can you click on Military and Veterans Affairs? So if you scroll down, keep going. So, Mr. Chairman.
Everybody should have a copy of the Military Veterans Report on your desk.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So with this particular one, unlike the one that we saw in revenue, you're not going to see amendments written like you did in the last one. That is the amendment instead, correct? I mean, if you scroll all the way down, you don't get anything besides ones that are in this format. So unlike the one that we just saw in revenue, where it looked more like what we're used to seeing,
correct,
this for the public would be the amendment to their list right here.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes. These are the amendments. They're exactly as passed out by the subcommittee because there are no language amendments. The purview of the subcommittee is the numbers section of the bill. And revenue has two extra amendments because language was involved.
And I'll follow, Mr. Chairman.
You can see what they did with the decrement, and here the transaction type is wordage, which means there is intent that was added by the committee. So you'll have an opportunity to see that early and vote on it.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Wilson.
And I understand that. I think this is going to be very difficult for the public to understand because they're not going to understand what the different formulations, and hopefully we'll explain that. But it's still, I mean, I understand this portion of it. So are you telling me, like in revenue, and I don't mean balance it back and forth, but there's two different types of papers in here. So the ones that look like the amendments that we used to have in revenue are just the language section. If it has nothing to do with language, then we're going to see the type of amendments that we just saw in Military and Veterans Affairs or at the beginning of revenue as well. So right there, So those are just our number changes, correct? And then as you scroll down, and thank you for the latitude, Mr. Chairman, and when we get down to the amendments like we were used to seeing, those are language changes.
Through the chair, that's correct, Representative Wilson. You'll see the L in front of the House Department of Revenue Amendment Number 3. Anytime you see an L, that's a signal that there is backup. That backup or supporting documentation would be the amendment prepared by legal services. The trouble with this amendment is that most people, including Finance Committee members, have no idea what this means. Page 57, page 59, 75, etc. Much of it is conforming. It doesn't tell you what it does at all. If you want, that's there for you to see, but the amendment itself is actually described here. It moves the cost recovery for paternity testing from language to section one, the numbers section. Here's what it does. It's added to numbers, and we put $50,000 in as an estimate. So hopefully it will be easier for both the committee members and the public to understand an amendment.
And Representative Wilson, I believe in the past, the language section all came in just in a CS, and it was not visibly seen by either the other finance committee members or by the public. So here we have all of these amendments are actually going to be coming before the committee in individual form of amendments, and you will see them and we will put the amendments up or down. But the amendments will be proposed just like the amendments that came out of the subcommittee that dealt with the number section of the bill, the language section of the bill amendments will be.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that, and I appreciate what you're trying to do. I was just making sure that we weren't looking at two different types of amendments, and where I thought it was a different amendment, it's actually backup to the amendments that are up here, so that we make sure we go to the end and don't miss anything before we get here. So thank you so much for your latitude. I greatly appreciate it.
Sure, thank you. And every member should realize that when you look at the amendments, if one is like the first one, HDOR, Department of Revenue 1, that's House, and that's a number section. And down below in number 3, you'll see it says L, House Department of Revenue Number 3. So that's the amendment, and the L on front indicates that this was a language amendment that came from the subcommittee chair of the operating budget to the language section, and if it has no L in front of it, it came from the numbers section, and that'll be in the subcommittee report, which will be each one of these agencies. We're going to, instead of having the language all at the end in a CS, what's going to happen is each agency comes forward, if there's any language amendments, those are going to be in the packet. There. Statewide amendments will be wrapped in at the end in the language section, but those will all come before the committee. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Out of curiosity on the Finance Subcommittee reports, in their narrative, they have recommendations that a standing committee change statutes for a particular item. There's quite a few of those listed. Are we allowed to object to that going to that committee and that particular, you know, a particular one of them, or what's the process on that part of it? Because some of them, you know, are going to be objected to, possibly one or two.
Well, the process is the subcommittees came forward, had discussions, and the subcommittee chair that was detailing with that budget, that those recommendations came forward from the subcommittee chair. If someone disagrees with those, they can, as a member of the House, can spool up a statutory change that they prefer. So if someone wants to introduce a bill to make a statutory change, these are the recommendations that came through the through that finance subcommittee, and those are going to go, they're going to be reported to us. We're not really debating those, or those are going to go from the subcommittee chair to the standing committee that it's there. If somebody disagrees with those, you can communicate to the standing committee chair. You can disagree with members, or you can talk to members of the standing committee that you didn't particularly like that one. And, you know, the standing committee might not go forward with that recommendation. Every House member has the opportunity to have that input into all the committees as well as on the floor, or if someone has had a recommendation that wasn't adopted by the subcommittee and came through that process, a member can always do that statutory amendment as a bill and present that through the legislature. So there's full opportunity for every member to do that. What we're trying to do is consolidate and look at budgetary impacts and have the finance subcommittees look at those, make recommendations to standing committees to clean up our statutes or get rid of indirect expenditures. And so those recommendations will be made by the subcommittee chairs directly to the standing committees. We're not really going to, we'll get reported, but we're not going to discuss and vote on those. Those have come through as standing, as subcommittee recommendations. Are there further questions on the process we're going to follow there? Mr. Teal, did you have more to show us on this
process? I don't, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, before we adjourn today, I'd like to make an announcement. Today is Mr. Teal's birthday. As an expression of our appreciation for his daily assistance to our committee, we have a small token of appreciation for him. Mr. Brown, would you come forward and bring a gab to the table?
Thank you.
And let's see what he...
More paper, just what I wanted. Aha, uh-huh. Look at that. That's very nice.
So,
yeah.
That's cool. Signed by the committee, and hopefully your back won't get as badly squeaked as it was the other day from your hockey. But we appreciate all your work with the committee. And there are treats on the back table.
Oh, good.
And before we get to the treats, in celebration of Mr. Teal's birthday, our next meeting is tomorrow, Thursday, February 23rd at 1:30. We'll hear a presentation from Callan Associates Incorporated on permanent fund forecasting methodology, variability and volatility discussion, and realized and unrealized earnings presentation. And we also expect to take up the subcommittee reports that you have on your desk on the Office of the Governor, Department of Military and Veteran Affairs, and the Department of Revenue. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned at 3:27.